focus.
All right, so despite the fact I haven't updated the syllabus, the plan for this week and next week is I want to try to dig into two pieces of work that you've done over the last couple of years and try to sort of pull some of this together. I keep threatening to do that, and I keep getting diverted. Before I forget, I've been asked to read a paper that showed up in the most recent SOSP on an operating system called Asbestos. I don't know what it is about operating system people. We pick names for things that kill people, and we use those for names for our systems, or that are otherwise socially unacceptable. I mean, Arrows, Fiasco, Asbestos. I mean, it's obviously we shouldn't be marketing. What?
Darwin.
Yeah. I'm waiting for somebody to come up with like the Christian right answer to the Darwin operating system. Not that I necessarily have a problem with it, but I'm wondering what it's going to be called.
It happened.
What was it called?
It was just a rant, wasn't it?
It was just a rant. Okay. All right. I mean, because I'm sure the name would be kind of intriguing, right? So, all right. So anyway, Asbestos was published, the second paper on Asbestos was published in the SOSP proceedings a couple of months ago. I believe it's now available online, and I encourage you to look at it. What's interesting about it to me is that they're looking at labeling and mandatory access control mechanisms. And I'm not yet far enough into the paper to actually understand what they've done, but I suspect I'm going to get there. So you might want to look at it, just because it's always good to know what's going on. So I want to dig in on the Windows system and try to capture first what are the issues. There's been a depressingly small amount of work on secure Windows systems. In fact, most of the work has tended in the other direction. Jim Geddes, Bob Scheifler, a few others, Phil Carlton, very actively decided when they were doing the X Windows system that their goal was to maximize sharing. Right? They wanted to maximize interoperability, and they succeeded. And the consequence is that the X Windows system, from a security perspective, is largely hopeless. And just to give you a sense of how bad the problem is in the X design, think about the protocol for cut and paste. Right? Anytime you do a selection, anytime you do a cut or a copy, the protocol is that the application in which you did the selection goes to the Windows system and says, I've got the selection! Okay, and any other application that wants to be notified of such a thing can be told, will be told, that event has occurred. So there used to be a widget, a little helper application, that you could run. In fact, it may even still be there. I think it was X Clipboard, which would just show you the content of the clipboard at all times. And there was a variant of X Clipboard, if I remember correctly, that would show you the content of the current selection, assuming that the utility knew how to render that content type. Furthermore, not only is the sort of X communication model, it's not so much open as promiscuous, but now, if I know you've got something, I can ask for it, right? So it's not the case. You might think it's the case that you say paste in an X application. It's not. It's rather the case that you make some mouse motions that the application interprets as paste. It turns around to the Windows server and requests that the paste buffer be provided. There's actually no causal connection that the Windows server can track between your mouse motions and the application's request to look at the cut buffer. Okay. There have been two pieces of work, and very closely related pieces. One was Trusted X, and the other was the Compartmented Mode Workstation work. And both of these were done, well, the final reports on them were 1987. Okay. 86, 87, 88 were the major publications. So you got to assume the work was basically done by 86 or 87. Okay. And the question was, how do we take this X window system and adapt it so that it can be used survivably in a multi-level secure environment where cut and paste has to be controlled? In the context of the Eros work, I wasn't enormously interested in multi-level security. I don't really believe that most users require multi-level security, and my discussions with people in the services suggest that for the most part, multi-level security isn't solving their problem either. It still does appear on RFCs, but multi-level security actually in the services gets in the way. Because if you think about what happens at those times when you're really under pressure or when you're trying to make decisions, right? It's very much like what happens in corporate workflow. There is an alleged process, there's a formal process, the process everything is supposed to go through, right? And it involves, you know, for a major purchase at a company, it involves five sign-offs. What inevitably happens is the third sign-off isn't around this week that you're trying to do the purchase, okay? And so what happens is you go to their boss, and their boss signs off for them, too. So what's interesting about the process is there are exceptions. There are also informal workarounds, right? Person is not physically present. You'll call them. You'll get a verbal okay. You'll go to their boss. You'll say, I've spoken to the person on the phone. I've got a verbal okay. He'll put the signature on the paper when he gets back. Boss will probably sign off. What boss knows is that you say it's okay, not that the person you called said it was okay. They're taking your word for that. Now, in military contexts, much the same is true. The vast majority of the time, people try in good faith to observe the compartment boundaries. Right? And they're actually pretty careful about it. I mean, if nothing else, they can go to jail for a long time for violating those boundaries. But you know, when somebody's shooting at you, you don't ask for permission to violate the compartment boundary to shoot back, right? When your buddy's just been shot, you shoot back and you apologize to your command structure later, unless you've been ordered to stay quiet, right? So there are circumstances where, and the key word is circumstantial, where the person on the scene makes a decision to violate a boundary. This may be 0.001% of the cases. I think it's actually not that small. I think it's larger than that. It's certainly not the majority of the cases. It's a small fraction. But that small fraction of the cases are the ones that let the system actually work. Right, so the thing about any formal process is the formal process can only describe some percentage of the right behaviors. Right? And then there are exceptions. And that's true in every formal system. So the problem is, yes, I mean, are there environments where I think you want to do multi-level security? Yeah, I think there are. Okay, but it turns out the most interesting security problem, if you're really serious about doing this, so here's an example of a really interesting security problem, right? It's the satellite photo classification problem. Right? We've got a bunch of people who sit at DIA and elsewhere, okay, and they get satellite feeds of satellite overhead imagery. Right? These photos don't come off the satellite pre-classified. They come off the satellite as bits. And somebody looks at them and makes a classification decision. And prior to the moment of that classification decision, they're not classified. Or really, they are classified, but they're classified sort of, you know, in the highest system compartment, right? And they actually have to get downgraded in order to establish their initial classification. So this whole model of MLS starts with a mistake, right? It fails to account for the process of how things initially get assigned to compartments. Right? And something, yeah.
Did someone define multi-level security in this context more clearly?
Let me give it a try. I don't actually want to get too diverted into this.
Yeah.
I've already gone more than I want. But so, generically, here's the idea. That you have a set of levels, okay, which start at public, okay, and go to top secret. Now, it doesn't really matter what these things are called. The point is you have levels, okay, and things are considered to be more sensitive as they go up in the levels. Okay. In addition, you have compartments. Okay. And you can think of compartments as in order to look at a particular piece of information, I have to both be cleared at the appropriate level, and I have to be cleared for all of the relevant compartments. Okay? So there's a vertical dimension and a horizontal dimension. Okay. So for example, and I'm making this up, okay, I might have a compartment describing nuclear secrets, okay, and I might have a compartment describing submarines. And there may be lots of stuff about submarines that pretty much anybody in the submarine fleet can get to. I mean, if I work on a submarine, it's really hard to keep the information, certain information away from me about the mechanical structure of a submarine, for example. Okay. But for me to get information about the power plant of a submarine, right, I might need to be both authorized for the nuke compartment and also authorized for the subcompartment. So what's really happening here is, think of this as a bit mask, okay, and this bit mask defines a power set of possible authorizations. Okay. And the tricky part is that new compartments are getting defined all the time, and so the structure has to be fairly fluid.
Does compartment go all the way up? That is there a nuclear compartment at every level so that you have access to the compartments from yours down that are the nuclear compartment?
The answer is I don't know.
Okay.
I think so, but the answer is I don't know. Do you happen to know?
They're two totally different concepts.
Right, but if I shift from one level up to the next level.
The nuclear compartment at secret is the same as the nuclear compartment at top secret.
Okay, so it's really a two-dimensional matrix, right, of levels in one axis and compartments in the other, but a compartment exists above.
Right, well, you either have or you don't have a compartment.
Okay, right. Yeah. Yeah. And as far as I know, compartments don't exist for things that are public. Would sort of be pointless. And I don't, there's, above public, there's a thing called no form for information that's not supposed to be disclosed to foreigners. And I don't, that one does have some compartment structure, but so for example, there's no form, there's stuff in no form that's okay to disclose to the British, but not okay to disclose to Afghanistan. And there's some funny categories like that. And they don't actually fall neatly into the classical MLS theory. Okay, so notice that the catch is that when I get in a satellite photo, I don't know which of these compartments it could go in, right? And it can't come in public. That would be bad, right? We don't want to start by publishing all the satellite photos. That would be awkward. Okay, so in fact, the first step that happens in that scenario is it gets downgraded into a compartment and a level, and that's a very strange operation in MLS. It's something that everybody understands has to happen, but it's outside of the formal model. So look, the point of all this is what happens when you implement MLS in a computational system is people read the specification, they say, oh, this is what MLS is supposed to do, and that's what they allow. And the problem with it is that 0.01% of the cases where the compartments get violated and people apologize and it's okay, the software won't allow those to happen. Now, let me say also that in a lot of those cases where the compartments get violated, in fact, it wasn't okay. So this is not an easy set of decisions to make. I think the point I really want to make here, though, is somebody toss me a razor. That historically, when we have talked about mandatory controls, the only mandatory control that we've talked about historically has been MLS. And MLS is a very restrictive kind of model. It's only recently that we've looked at other things like role-based access control, and there's some debate about how powerful these things are and how appropriate they are to certain applications. My point here is only that I don't think this model is generally appropriate for businesses. Businesses run a lot looser than this. And businesses are much more concerned with what are the rules particular to an application than establishing some matrix describing how information can flow. So we want something more flexible. On the other hand, businesses are very concerned with viruses, worms, insiders tampering with data is actually a big concern. And have I told you guys about the AC Delco thing? So some years ago, AC Delco went through a four-month period when they didn't ship spark plugs. And what had happened was they fired somebody who, and they made the mistake of allowing this person to go back to his desk on the way out the door, and he deleted the AC Delco spark plug design database. This is not a joke. Okay? And cars didn't ship for like 4 months. And this is not particularly something that Delco wants public. I happen to know one of the people who was on the forensics group that rebuilt their data set. By block by block disk level analysis, and it was not pretty. Okay, so my view when we started the Windows system stuff was not that I wanted to do MLS. I wanted to have a story for being able to do MLS. But my view is, look, the guy sitting at the keyboard, if I show him the information, pretty much they can walk away with it. And in most of the environments we're going to look at, if I put up a document, it can be printed. And, you know, barring installations where we put up barbed wire fences and we have people with guns, we're not going to strip search people as they exit the building. If they print a document, they can take it with them. Okay. There are places where that's not true, but the vast majority of places, that's sort of the working assumption. Right? So the test is not, do I want to restrict what this person does? Because I've already decided as a social matter that I'm not willing to do what it takes to restrict that behavior. But what I would like to do is I'd like to make sure that if information moves from one place to another, that it actually moved because the person said so. And in some cases, I want to make sure that the person can only get to the information by going through some application that we have some reason to have confidence in. So, for example, if I want to give the human resources people the ability to look at salary data but not to change it, okay, that's not an easy thing to describe in a permission system. We can describe a policy, but implementing that policy is going to have to be done by the application, because at the end of the day, you don't have write access on a field in a database. You have write access in a database. And yes, we can do more complicated protections in databases, but at that point we step off of the standards, right? And we start getting married to a particular database, and that's actually not a good thing to be. So what we actually do is we rely on application code that's going to perform certain checks, and then what we want to do is make sure the application is actually running. So the user is actually using this application. Why? Because the application is applying protection. I don't want it to be the case that when JavaScript runs in some piece of email that you're viewing, that it gets to look at your cut buffer. I definitely don't want it to be the case that it gets to go to the Windows system and kill other applications. You may have noticed when you're running your web browser and you get redirected someplace unpleasant, right? Your window starts by maximizing often. So the goal here was, how do we design a Windows system where the user cannot be disintermediated? And it turns out if you can do that, you're most of the way to MLS, because what that means is, in order to do any of this, anytime you have an interaction between two applications, you have a predicate you're going to run, and that predicate is going to say yes or no. And the predicate that's of interest to me is, did the user actually say this? But if you wanted to do the MLS predicate, you could add labels to Windows, and you could make that part of the predicate structure. So the question basically is, how do you get a chance to run this predicate?
So, issue one is, controlling communication. Issue two is denial of service.
And I'm not convinced we solve this. But how do I make it the case that a client can't bury the Windows system in requests with the consequence that it becomes non-responsive?
Issue three is denial of resource.
One of the things in the X model that's really, really difficult is that a client can come along and they can request as much storage as they want. The X Windows system has a protocol where the client can go and actually put arbitrary bit vectors, and name them. It can introduce things called atoms. Now, there is hypothetically a protocol by which the Windows system is entitled under extreme conditions to drop these things on the floor. In practice, applications fail when that happens. There's also a problem. The atom namespace is global.
Last thing is the event system. So,
one of the things that Jim and Bob and Phil were very concerned about was remote execution. So they want to be able to render one place, for example, decompress a movie. Okay? And sorry, not render. Process in one place and visualize in another place. Right? Now, so they have this idea that the protocol should be remotable. And one of the problems they ran into in X10 was the protocol was a remote procedure call oriented protocol. So what would happen is you'd send a request to a remote display, it would go across a 10 megabit Ethernet, you know, and 50 milliseconds later you'd get back a reply, and those 50 milliseconds add up. In X11, they moved to a protocol that's much more streamable and much more message oriented. And there are ways to synchronize, but you try like hell to avoid them. One of the problems is that if the display is remote, I don't know when to draw. Right? So the protocol has it that when my window gets exposed, you close the window behind it becomes visible. That one of two things can happen. The first is that it is permitted for the window system to implement what are called safe behinds or backing store. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. The reason it didn't happen was that backing store became subject to a patent, which patent I believe has now expired. Actually, I think the patent was by Rob Pike, and he was quite upset about it when he realized that the implication was people couldn't do a decent window system. The other option, and it's an option even if the server implements backing store because memory is not infinite, is that the server can go back to the client and say, here's a region that has just been exposed. Please redraw this region. Now, consequence of this is that simply by creating and removing windows, I can get the window manager, the X window manager, to send messages to other applications. And I can get them set with pretty high robustness. So, as fast as I can create and destroy windows, I can send bits to other messages. Excuse me, I can send bits to other processes, right? So this is actually The world's stupidest interprocess communication mechanism. Right? But, so here's an interesting exercise, right? Consider the problem that I want to use the X window system as an IPC channel, but I want to do it not using the design mechanisms, and there are designed mechanisms in X, right? I want to do it using stupid exposures. Right? So what I want to do is I want to implement TCP/IP over expose events. Right? And that sounds silly, but it's very doable. I have this list, by the way, of covert channel toolkits that I want to build so that we can quit arguing about the importance of covert channels. Because after there are toolkits to use them, people will use them all the time. And, you know, and after people use them all the time, we'll actually have to solve the problem. And of course, now I'm on tape having said this, and this means either that somebody's going to come shoot me or somebody's going to come hand me money. If they hand me money, they're going to be from China. If they shoot me, they're going to be from Washington. So if I don't show up for class next week, you know, that's what happened. Okay. All right. What was the other thing? What was something else?
Yeah, but that's... Okay, so, right, thank you. I wasn't actually going to go for that.
Short version, the X window system is more complicated than the operating system. This is not something that's really a feature in a high robustness part of a system. It's definitely something you want to have better isolation on. One of the big changes that's coming in Fedora Core 5 is finally actually broken X up into multiple packages. And X is trying to slim down. I'm not convinced it's succeeding, but it's trying. Now, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with complexity. And complexity may be unavoidable, but there are structural issues that you don't want to put complexity in the wrong places, and you don't want to rely on it for the wrong things. Even if I have a fast graphics pipeline, there may be applications where I would prefer not to use that. Okay. And the sixth issue is this issue of cut and paste. So the problem here is the protocol in X is I say, I've got the cut buffer, and the other application says, I want the cut buffer. And the first guy says, good, I'll give it to you in peanut butter, raspberry, or chocolate milk. Okay? And the receiving application says, ah, crap, I don't want peanut butter and chocolate milk. I really wanted kiwi pie. And the first application says, good, I know how to bake kiwi pie. And it sends over the data in kiwi pie format. Well, this protocol negotiating formats can go back and forth as many times as you want. Okay? Can you say IPC? Right? This is sort of, you know, this is another covert channel. This is a short list of covert channel toolkits I want to build. You know, maybe I should submit that to NSF, if only to get people really annoyed at me. Not that they need any help. Okay, so what are the serious issues? I'm not convinced that we solve POS, but let me explain the problem. The X window system queues requests. So a request comes in from a client, and it does not get processed immediately. It gets put into a queue, and then requests get pulled off the queue. Now, here's the problem. Because of this, requests are processed on the schedule of the window server, not on the schedule of the client. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it does create a two-level scheduler. And it creates a two-level scheduler in which the X window system is not aware of what's happening at lower levels with the scheduling engine. So there's a problem there. And one consequence of this is, if I jam enough requests into the queue, your requests will be deserviced. So one of the things that we'd like to do is move drawing out of the window system. Right? There's some amount of stuff the window system just has to do. But we'd like it to be the case that it doesn't do that as a consequence of application activity, that rather it does it as a consequence of user activity. Why? Users are very slow peripherals. We get lots of time to deal with stuff for the user. So, start with denial of resources. The main problem with denial of resource is I can queue up an arbitrary set of requests. Now, the exponent of the system is free to block me, but now what happens is I have a server, it's doing flow control and it's doing buffer management and it's doing all of this across some very large number of connections. That's just hard. Never mind whether you can do it, why should you do it? Okay. I mean, obviously you've got to have multiple connections, but is this really what you want to be doing? And yes, you can even do it mostly in bounded storage if we ignore things like the Atom stuff and the ability to upload PIX maps to the web server, to the next server. But why? So here's the alternative. Suppose we said, this is going to sound a little crazy, the Windows server shouldn't do the rendering at all. That's not its job. Suppose we said the application should do the rendering. And what this means is, instead of the Windows system providing a service in which it accepts commands to render, the Windows system is going to provide a service in which it agrees to share a bitmap with an application. The application will advise the Windows system when portions of the bitmap have changed, and the Windows system will, at its discretion, render from the bitmap into the frame buffer. Now, I understand I've just lost the graphics pipeline story. I want to start with the bitmap story, and we'll talk about what to do about the graphics pipeline by the time this is over. So simply by having a shared bitmap, we get to move all the graphics render code into the application. So this is start from the assumption we're using dumb frame buffer. And by the way, that's not as crazy as it sounds. Unless you're doing bleeding edge games, dumb frame buffer is plenty fast enough. More than ample for doing movies. Okay, problem. Who gets to decide how big the bitmap is? Can't be the Windows system, because Windows system can't pay for the storage. So here's what we want to do. We want to build a bitmap that's paid for by the client, but mapped by the Windows system. Now, if we're not careful about this, the Windows system is going to run out of virtual address space, so we're going to do window mappings onto this thing in the limit, but that's all. Now, there's only one problem with this, ignoring performance, which turns out is not as big a problem as it sounds. Which is, if I'm in charge of who creates the bitmap, if I pay for it, I'm also in charge of the fault handling policy for that memory region. Now there's a problem that the Windows system is going to do read, right, where the information is flowing back to the Windows system, and if the client, imagine the client's hostile. So the client wants the Windows system to fail. What the client could do is just take away a page or cancel the entire bitmap, just destroy it. Better still, take away a page. So now the Windows system goes to read, the page is not present. That causes a fault to be generated, and that fault is going to go to a fault handler. Which fault handler? Well, whatever fault handler the fabricator of that space put there, which in this case is the client. So what we've just done is created a circumstance where the client is able to cause a fault in the Windows server, and the effect of the fault is for the control flow to end up subject to the control of the client, because control gets transferred to the fault handler, and the Windows server will not proceed until the fault handler returns control.
The fault handler is under control of the client, and it may never do so. On the other hand, we can't not have a fault handler. Because the first time you touch those pages, they really aren't going to be valid, and we really do need to get them defined. They're sort of generically, so everybody see the problem? The problem here is a denial of control flow problem. Looking puzzled. So everybody see that the window system could take a fault that would cause it to block indefinitely, subject to the whim of the client. Alright. Generically, there are two ways to solve this. The first is to say, well, I'll put the fault handler in the kernel. And how do you put the fault handler in the kernel? Both guys know what the policy is. Okay, and now I'm no longer at the mercy of the fault handler. The catch is, now I've also dictated a policy about the fault handler, which is something we were hoping to avoid. And it's still the case now that either I'm going to have a reference counting system and therefore a denial of resource problem, or I'm going to have it be possible that this region could be destroyed, and therefore a possible fault in the window system. Well, what can we do instead? The goal here was not for the client to construct the space. That was not the goal. The goal was for the client to pay for the space. The window system needs to, doesn't necessarily need to control, but needs to know what the policy for fault handling in the space is. And that can be done in two ways. One is the window system builds the space using storage supplied by the client. The other is the client builds the space, but the window system is somehow in a position to validate it. So if there was a mechanism for the window system to say, I will use the space, but only if the fault handler is an instance of the virtual copy keeper that's part of the system, part of my TCB, and I'm willing to trust it, even though I don't trust the client.
You could use a shared buffer object in this case, yeah.
Well, the question here is, how do we build that shared buffer object safely? Right? That's what we're talking about. You're talking about a trusted buffer object.
Yeah.
No, this is not a trusted buffer object. It's a different problem. There are some common elements to the two problems, but this is a slightly different scenario. Okay. Well, can we? If we have first-class storage allocation, we can't stop the client from destroying the space. So it is possible that the client could cause the window system to take a fault allocating this space exactly once. Because if that fault ever happens, the client has reneged on the contract, and the thing to do next is shut the client session down. But it does mean that accesses to this buffer have to be done with some care. So what the windowing system needs to know is, if it should take a fault in this space, what will the fault handler do? So it needs to know what code the fault handler process obeys. In fact, what we did was, we simply had the window system create the space and hand the capability back to the client, but it was created using client-supplied storage. Okay. So the client is paying for the majority of the space here. The one piece that the client does not pay for in this design, there is a per-client session data structure that comes out of the Windows Server scheme, and we have not yet found a clean way to eliminate that data structure. Or more precisely, we haven't found a clean way to move it to something the client pays for. So, that gets rid of most of the denial of resource issue. And the key to it was the factoring of two things. The ability
to separate the source of storage from the creation of an object. Right? And the ability to factor fault handling policy so that the right party was in control. The second one has been very common in most microkernels. The first one, as far as I know, is still unique to the Kiko's Aerosystem. So these three things are tough. In X, the model is exposed events, and then the client issues arbitrary draw commands to the window system. In EWS, we invert that relationship. The client updates its bitmap, and after updating the bitmap, it issues a message to the window system, and it's a change advise message. It says, here is a rectangular region, and some or all of the bits inside this region have changed. It would be convenient if you would update the display as needed. Okay. But instead of the window system advising the client of the need to redraw, the client advises the window system of the presence of a change. In fact, that may not lead to a redraw. It will only lead to a redraw if that window is currently in front. And if that window is currently in front, right, there's only one operation we're going to do. We're going to do dit lift. Or raster off if you're older than 60. Same operation. So that's the only... Go ahead.
In front, like the window in front?
If it's the window in the very front.
So if it's an exposed window, but it's not the front window, then it doesn't update?
It does, in fact, yes. So if the region...
Visible.
What really happens is the window system does a visibility check, and it redraws those portions that are visible. And in fact, it turns out that's not really what you want to do. It turns out what you really want to do is start building a dirty list and at the next vertical retrace then with those in your frame buffer, because otherwise you get display artifacts. And it turns out that during vertical retrace, you're not competing with the graphics chip for access to the graphics memory because it's waiting too. So you try to do these things during retrace intervals. It's amazing, by the way, how few window systems get that wrong. And that's part of why people think that bitmaps are slow. Okay. So, under what other conditions does it draw? Well, you know, the other thing that can happen is a window moves. Right? And so when a window moves, two things happen. Right? One is that there's a bitlet of the window bits. Right, moving the window doesn't change its content. But the other is that windows behind it may get exposed. Okay? So what happens now is the window system computes a list of regions that need to be redrawn. Okay? So there are two ways you get on that list. One is something gets exposed by virtue of a move, and the other is something gets put on the list as a consequence of an advice from the application saying this region moved, this region changed. Now it's got to go through and redraw those regions. What it does is it breaks each region down into subregions that are exactly all within one window. And it goes back to the bitmap associated with that window, and it does a bitlet from the memory region. So if you actually were to look at the EWS code, you'd discover, I think there are only two operations that we need. Right? One is bitlet, the other is line draw for horizontal and vertical lines. And I think there may be a rectangular fill operation. That's it. There's no graphics rendering system here to speak of. I mean, it turns out Bitlit is powerful enough that you can do everything else with it, with, you know, if you're willing to pay enough. There's a little bit of font rendering code. So the current Windows system has a built-in font that it uses for labeling. And it uses that to do window titles. So it knows how to render one font. But it does that with Bitlit too. Okay, so two things just happened. One is that we inverted the event relationship, right? So now there's no expose events going back. That channel's gone. And that was probably the big channel in X. The rest of it was solvable. Because I could put forward an atom, and you could ask if the atom was there, but the absence of the atom doesn't tell you anything, right? There's nothing in the contract that says that the Windows system can't flush those things. So one thing that we can do is we can just separate those spaces and behavior won't change. People do use atoms for communication in X. Strictly speaking, it's a violation protocol. We've also eliminated the graphics operations from the Windows system, right? All that complexity now moves to the application. Now, the bad news is it's not gone, but the good news is it's no longer being done in a place where we really have to trust the code seriously. There's a cost, and I'll pick this up tomorrow. Shared memory designs do not remote well. There's been a lot of... So one of the things you'll see in the operating system literature, every 5 years there's a flurry of distributed shared memory papers. Nobody cares other than the authors. I've heard people at Microsoft saying, God save us, if we never see another distributed shared memory paper, it'll be too soon. Okay. And the moral of the story is, distributed shared memory doesn't work. It has crappy performance characteristics. And the reason it has crappy performance characteristics is applications don't interact with other pieces of the same application in units of pages. So page faulting turns out to be a very slow way to move data. There are applications for which DSM works very well. Okay, and after you've supported all six of those, you're done with DSM. Jim Gettys has argued that this is a poor design because, in his view, it does not support remoting. That's not right. It is true that the bitmap sharing doesn't work well remotely. That does not preclude building an end-to-end rendering pipeline as the first client. And remember, I still have to tell you how the graphics pipeline works, which is another way out of this. But I believe that Jim's design assumptions are predicated on a mistake, or at least an assumption I disagree with. Ask yourself, in the X window system, right, what's the trend? The trend is to the direct rendering interface. Okay? And the reason is that inter-process communication is slow. People are moving to DRI because they need the performance. Okay? Now, what they do want is a fallback so that when they can establish a shared memory region, they have an alternate way to go. Great. What does it mean to have an application that doesn't remote well? It means it's a bandwidth intensive application, because I can build a render pipeline, right? I'll put the bitmap on the client, I'll stick a render pair between me and the client, no problems. In fact, we do it all the time. VNC works pretty well. And VNC is implemented really badly. So ask yourself, what applications am I leaving out? One, games. Believe me, you're not going to play games over a 1 megabit render link. It's not happening. You don't have DRI, you're just not going to get that number of polygons. I'm sorry. So we're done with that. So what's left is movies and audio. Okay, and audio is not an X Windows problem, although you do want some synchronization. Now what about the movies? Let me see if I got this right. I want to do the rendering on one system, and I want to do the decoding on one system, and I want to do the rendering on another. and I want to do this over a network link. Explain to me again why it is that I should take this carefully compacted MPEG or DivX or take your favorite format, right, expand it by a factor of 20, and then ship the bits over the wire? Jim says, power. Running codecs is expensive. I said, but Jim, running Ethernet isn't? What's wrong with this picture? Okay, more ways than one. Now, in fact, that's a little too easy. It's a little too glittery. Okay, it is the case that the good codecs require CPU-intensive processing, and there really is a power cost to running the decoder. Well, you have to do it somewhere, okay? But it is true that the decoder for bitmaps is a hell of a lot simpler than the decoder for MPEG. Setting aside the question of whether there is anything called MPEG, MPEG is actually a panoply of standards shoved under one label. And I might want to transcode the video, right? I might know that I'm going to lower resolution. I might want to have a translator in the loop, right? But the real question is, why did I want to put bandwidth pressure on the precious link? If I'm going to a handheld device, no. I mean, the right solution is actually to down-convert and then ship to the handheld device and then do the decoding there. Because even if the decoding's expensive, I'm only going to do the decoding for the device. And now I'm doing the local scenario. This is exactly like putting a graphics pipeline between the client and the server, except that one of them was a rendering operation pipeline, the other one was an MPEG decoder pipeline. But it's the same principle of design. Okay. So I do not buy the argument that the shared bitmap violates remoting. In fact, quite the contrary, I would say the shared bitmap forces you to do remoting sensibly. And the evidence that it does not violate remoting is it works on Windows, and Windows relies on this design. Windows does not provide a remote rendering service until very late in the game, and by the time it existed, the level of dependency on the local assumption was awesome. And it's a procedure call interface, by the way. Really hard to run it fast over a wire. Okay. Tomorrow, I'm going to come back and I'm going to tackle cut and paste. The point I'm trying to bring out here, though, is I'm trying to take the pieces that we've seen. So in this case, storage is the space bank, okay, the fault handlers, the first class memory objects. You need those to do this, right? Trying to take the pieces that we've seen and sort of pull them together to do some things that are challenging. And it's all about factors. Okay, see you tomorrow. I know I promised you midterm today. I don't have it written yet. I was going to say I would do it tonight. I don't know that I'm going to get to it, but it will be this week that you'll get it.